The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And in this morning's Campus Voices, you're going to go with intern Kayla Baptiste and myself up to the grand opening of the University Museum's exhibition, Blue and Black, African Rainbow, which is appearing now in the Mechanical Hall Gallery on the university campus and will be available through May 15th. You'll hear a lot of music and talk and bustle and noise. You'll pick up the excitement that happened on the university campus back on February 10th for the opening of Blue and Black, African Rainbow. Welcoming us to the Mechanical Hall Gallery was Ivan Henderson, Curator of Education for University Museums. Good evening, Ivan.
Good evening, Richard.
Today, Kayla and I are up in the Mechanical Hall Gallery, to where the University of Delaware's Spring 2016 exhibition is.
Blue and Black, African Rainbow.
Tell us a little bit about this exhibit that Julie McGee put together.
So the exhibition this semester features work that is all from the university's permanent collection, which is really important. A number of the works on display would have come with the Paul R. Jones gift. Some would have come attached to that gift or related to the gift afterwards, especially the prints from the Brandywine Workshop. And even some works of art that predate the Paul R. Jones gift are all on display this semester. We're looking at various modes of creative expression in the African-American community and across the African diaspora. So you'll see, of course, representations of performance, both stage performance, musical performance, representations of dance and other things. But you'll also see representations of belief systems, either, you know, completely sort of researched and historically accurate, or in many cases, belief systems that are composed of a little bit of history, some of the things that we imagine about ourselves, some of our sort of family narratives over the years. In this way, African Americans and Africans all over the world find a way to connect themselves or reconnect their roots, which may have been, you know, disrupted or broken by the transatlantic slave trade, especially the Middle Passage, or a number of other things that prevent us from knowing our history. So it's really a great mix of African Americans and Africans across the diaspora controlling the narrative and expressing that in this exhibition.
Before we began our formal tour of the exhibition, Curator Julie McGee talked with Kayla and myself about Ashanti Johnson's pastels.
What year do you think these are from? What do they think of when you look at them stylistically? What do they suggest to you?
1968.
I think like 2000s, because I don't know, like the colors are so bright and everything, and I think more modern times.
That's good. I mean, that's exactly what we're hoping. They're from 1977, actually, kind of the height of the Black Arts Movement, but that has come back in fashion. And so the fact that you kind of see it as contemporary is because we see this kind of contemporary brilliance and kaleidoscopic color and even references to kente cloth. We see that out there now. Mm-hmm. So it has this, like, today's resonance, mm-hmm. and you're like, that's from 1977? I'm sure that's before you were born, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you recognize it because you're old enough to actually, like me, to have known this period, right? Coming out of the civil rights movement, psychedelic stuff, album covers from the same period, but they're both by Amos Ashanti Johnson. He did this large pastel as well down here in the corner, and we've got a couple of other works
so
in the gallery by
that's
him.
Also pastel.
Yep, that's also pastel. There's a image that Amos Ashanti Johnson did that's of Isaac Hayes that we have in the other gallery. But we definitely want to see what students get out of these images. This is actually this is what the show's named after, African Rainbow, because that's the title of this work. And he took on the name Ashanti as a moniker. His name's Amos Johnson, but he calls himself Amos Ashanti Johnson because he's really interested in Ghana and Africa. So some of the symbolism that you see is influenced by Ghanaian symbols, especially Adinkra.
Ivan Henderson, joined frequently by Julie McGee, then took us on a formal tour of the exhibition. Julie was telling Kale and me earlier about African Rainbow.
It's a wonderful piece from 1977 by Amos Ashanti Johnson. And here's a great example of some of the things I talk about. He's an African-American artist who still resides in South Carolina who learned about the Ashanti or Ashanti people of West Africa. Along with that, learns some of the systems of representing ideas and thoughts. So you'll see Adinkra symbols, some of the same symbols that we've seen associated with African-American holidays like Kwanzaa and other things across the diaspora. He's sort of incorporated into his art. And, of course, he's even added the Ashanti name as his middle name and how he's known over the years in the art world. This was heavily influenced by the 1968 formation of AfroCobra, which is an artist collective interested in promoting ideas of black beauty and African-American strength and power. He'd never joined AfroCobra, but by 1977, all of his work was clearly influenced by some of their ideas around a new positive way of looking at African identity.
Why don't you take us to some of the works that were done by the Brandywine Workshop?
Certainly. This is a work by Weldon Butler, completed at the Brandywine Workshop right in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The name of this piece is Blue Rondo. And the reason I brought you to this is because I don't hear the word rondo too often. And so I went to look it up, a type of music. I believe that this is a reference to the rondo as discovered by Dave Brubeck. He first releases a piece entitled Blue Rondo a la Turk in 1959. Having visited Turkey and hearing street musicians playing, you know, an impossible melody that, you know, he couldn't imagine sort of who made this up. So he asked them. The Turkish musicians told him, "This melody to us is what jazz is to you." To say it's just part of them, it's not something they sort of think about where it came from. So from there, he came back and created Blue Rondo, which I've listened to in preparation for this exhibition and realized I've heard it all my life. It's one of those things that a lot of folks know well, even if they don't know by name. So here we have a work by Weldon Butler with the same title, Blue Rondo, and I think about that set of ideas. Even if this isn't a reference to any of the melodies in Brubeck's piece, it's the idea that although the melody or the tune sounds foreign to you, for another person, it's as simple as breathing air or waking up every morning. It's just part of who they are. So there's sort of a rhythm, maybe in his art, maybe in the world around him, or in the music in particular around him, that is perhaps something he's born with, but that others have to learn and ask about.
Tell us some more about the actual Brandywine Workshop.
So the Brandywine Workshop is a workshop in Philadelphia. It's a place for printmakers to come and learn to make prints. They were founded with the idea that printmaking is one of those democratic processes to which a lot of folks are able to have access, both to create things, but also folks who want to consume objects of art are able to get a hold of prints, sometimes at a much lower price than other types of objects. So it's something that they're able to use to teach art making to folks, but also to teach people to appreciate and consume art. Brandywine Workshop was started by Alan Edmonds and a group of professionals in Philadelphia, and very early they learned to get quote-unquote established, well-known artists into the workshop to teach, and at the same time they've kept a number of up-and-coming artists in the workshop learning how to keep the workshop going, run the machines, and push the envelope, consider new ways of creating things.
I would like to add that the reason it's called the Brandywine Workshop, and there's often confusion because this is the Brandywine Valley. It was started on Brandywine Street in a garage in Philadelphia. Yeah. So it has retained that name, but because there's such a significance to the Brandywine Valley and Brandywine art, it's important to say, yes, it has that name, but it's a street name.
Of all the things that are in here, what is your favorite piece, Julie?
I don't pick favorites. I'm a curator. What's your favorite? You just walked in.
Well, I really like the piece.
The African rainbow or the other one?
The other one.
Hermes Trismegistus.
The pretty, like, I guess it's because of the colors. And, well, purple's my favorite color and it's kind of like
And the twisted
prominent.
Faces.
Yeah, and it's just like a different take on like art in general. And especially to see that there's like a lot of African American artists that I did not know about. So it just... That piece really stuck out to me.
There are three large pastels that are approximately 4 by 8 feet, 4 by 8.5 feet. And what Amos Ashanti Johnson told me is that he did three of that size. The third one, he doesn't know where that is now. It's called Womb of Life. So there were three that were part of a series. And you can get a sense from African Rainbow, which has a self-portrait profile on the left, that it and this relationship to the continent of Africa. I think you spoke about that as well. And Hermes Trismegistus, this idea of the celestial thrice-born Hermes that connects both the underworld with the celestial world, that it is something about life connections. And I think that's what he's relating back to the continent of Africa, that everything is connected to everything, so that the ancestral past is also our present and our future. And I think you see that kind of spinning, faceted heads that are moving in multiple directions. So Hermes is related to Mercury, and Mercury was the swift-footed god. And you also have some Egyptian relationships. So it's really, I think, the artist's attempt to connect us to more global and celestial understandings of the world in which he finds himself and his center in an African rainbow.
Having Hermes in the name, I mean, like you're saying, that's from classical mythology. You know, you're saying Hermes and Mercury, Greek and Roman. And so that implies to me he's trying to tie the work into more than just his African-American experience.
But Hermes Trismegistus is also related to Egyptian gods. So remember, there's this whole tradition of mythology that comes out of Egypt, ancient Egypt, which weds what we might think of more as the classical Greek gods with Egyptian gods, and that's what he's speaking to.
Ivan, what's this one behind you there?
I was hoping you'd ask. We have another work by Amos Ashanti Johnson. This from 1978, and it's an image of Isaac Hayes, who very famously wore this an outfit for a performance. And part of that outfit, of course, is a vest made of chains, designed for him by someone else.
Charles Rubin designed a chain vest, right, chain link vest.
Right.
For
and so Isaac Hayes, as he plans to, you know, wear this, maybe thought it was cool in the first place, but from what I've read, it seems like upon, you know, a little brief reflection, realizes that he's taking control of the chains in a sense, that at this point in American and world history, we know about Africans in chains, and especially the way that so many African Americans' families came to this country originally. Here's an opportunity for an artist at the height of his powers and popularity to take control of those chains in a sense, and make them conform to his shape and adorn him instead of hold him back. So it's quite a twist to wear the chains in that way. It's even more remarkable to see them represented in this way by an artist. We were just looking at this and talking about it earlier today, that, you know, in many cases, you start with a white background and sort of add your color or shading to it. In this case, Amos Ashanti Johnson, once again, has started with the dark background, with the black background, and in a way causes the image of Isaac Hayes and the symbology of that chain vest to emerge from the darkness and in full power. It's really, you know, as a former performing artist myself and as a person who loves to look back and wonder what it was like to live and feel music of this era, it's really, you know, gratifying to see this image hanging here and know that I'll get to talk to 1,000 young folks about it this semester.
Yeah, who's Isaac Hayes? Who is B.B. King? Both of them emerging out of blackness. You know, I'm black, I'm proud, mm-hmm. right? That's this wonderful emergence out of the darkness is Isaac Hayes. This whole exhibition, in addition to those large pastels by Amos Ashanti Johnson, one of the goals of the exhibition is to celebrate a variety of arts. So performance, singing, dancing. We have a number of images that refer to dancing, poetry. So it is their inter-arts action and artist interest in crossover art forms that we see in the gallery that we're hoping people will walk away with. So artists who are interested in musical production, artists who are interested in dance, who then turn to the visual to pay homage to that. That's a really exciting thing, and kind of an appreciation for the different languages that artists use across platforms and disciplines.
I saw in the little side room here, there were a bunch of, look like monochromatic black and white works. Should we go look at those? Oh, wow, it's like a whole series.
So this is great. The pieces you've asked about that we've stopped at are also, I led my first tour at 1201. We opened at noon today, so first tour at 1201. And these are all the pieces that were asked about. So this is a piece called, or a series called Children of the Middle Passage by Arturo Lindsay. Lindsay is a Panamanian-born artist who still lives in Panama and works and teaches in an artist community, but whose inspiration for these pieces came from learning a little bit about local history. And you'll find this in Panama, in South America, and all over the world in different places. There are groups of Africans who, in order to escape enslavement at a time in Panama's history, sort of set out on their own. They're known as the Cimarrones. And you find similar groups with similar names. I had a student here from a Caribbean island who told of a similar cultural group today as she looked at this. But there's sort of the legend and a prideful retelling of their escape from enslavement and their ability to sort of make it on their own, or at least get away from being owned for a while. And so they've become sort of a subgroup, an ethnic group in Panama. And learning about them and wondering about, and wanting to learn more about that group, the Cimarrones, and wondering, you know, how all these Africans from different parts of the continent end up in all these different places all over the world, Lindsay began to think about all those who must have perished along the way as well. We hear about the Middle Passage and know, you know, half of the folks, if not more, maybe a little bit less, but a great portion of folks who were originally loaded onto ships and intended to be human servants never made it to the final destination. So in a way, the children of the Middle Passage is a tribute to them. Maybe he's putting face to those who were lost, or maybe he's acknowledging the descendants of those who actually made it to the New World. Some of these children, of course, would be the Cimarrones, and some of them would be me.
It's like this whole series. There's that each piece has like a structure. I mean, like there's a little sign above each child, and then it's as if each child is wrapped in a shroud with a different symbol on it. And at the bottom, there's another symbol or set of images.
Right, and once again, I've been working with students all day to decode this, and I'm still becoming familiar myself. But you picked right up on it. There's a framing mechanism, either a window, or I've heard folks say, well, it looks like a coffin. Once they start getting into the subject matter, it looks like a box for burial, surrounding each face or each person. But then you also see at the bottom, usually something dealing with maritime, the maritime profession. You'll see boats, cargo ships, or implements dealing with living at sea. You also see at the bottom of each image, or at the bottom of many images, shackles, right, chains, things that might call to mind legacies of bondage. Other than that, each individual has a name. It's embedded in the image, as well as a region, an ethnic group, or a cultural group from which they descend. All of these are real cultural groups, maybe made up by the artist and matched to these young folks, but they are real places in the world and real ethnic groups which existed, real names. So once again, making them whole and perhaps breathing a little bit of life and honor back into those who would have perished at sea on their way to the Americas.
Caleb Baptiste, with a name like that, it sounds like your family might have come from an area like this. What's your reaction?
My family is from Trinidad and Tobago, so like all of these are just kind of reminiscent of like Caribbean culture and everything. And especially I wanted to point out that like each of these children had like little halo things, so I think about like the religious aspect too, when you think of like Jesus Christ and like the whole halo and like innocence and everything, and these children were taken away from their land and placed into places where they didn't know, and they were trying to survive and everything. So and I also noticed that Lagos, I remember from anthropology class, I think that's in Nigeria.
Yes.
So most of these places like mean something to those particular children, and I don't know, I just thought back to my Caribbean American roots. So
I think those are perceptive comments there, Kayla, because it's about who these children were, where they came from, where they ended up, and what happened to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And to go along with that, I think those are great observations. Once again, I had a student who's from a Caribbean area earlier today began to talk about this, and it brought me back to my wife's Bahamian family and some of the same, you know, just maybe right at the edge, but there's connections between all of these histories across the diaspora and the transatlantic slave trade. In each case, you'll see symbols. Letters, words, or like symbols like the Adinkra symbols, which will also represent that ethnic group, and which should align with the name that the artist has assigned to the child as well. So there's obviously a lot of, you know, straight up historical research that goes into this, but along with that, you know, some imagination and the ability to bring these lost souls or souls perhaps that never existed back to life and sort of back to our minds.
Are these lithographs?
Yes.
That's what it looks like to me.
Yes, offset lithographs.
Tell us about that work over there.
The piece we're looking at now is Maka Wakasa by Kaylin Sullivan Two Trees, produced in 1992. Kaylin Sullivan Two Trees, first of all, is this work was produced at Brandywine Workshop, so it's another representative of some of the art that comes from this region. Another great thing about this work or about the artist is that she is a representation of a woman whose work is on display. Shouldn't be remarkable at this point, but still, in many collections and many galleries, the men far outnumber the women. Our curator of African American art obviously is a woman. Our director is a woman. At the very least, we'll be aware and even-handed when possible about representing whose work is shown in the gallery. Based on merit, but also inclusive of anyone we can. Kaylin Sullivan Two Trees' work is remarkable in that Maka Wakasa, the words are Native American words and actually translate into earth person. So in a sense, this image is rife with symbols that would be meaningful to those of Native American descent or those who know a little bit about that. At the same time, in pointing out that individuality or that cultural sort of specificity, she uses that language and those words to give us the most generic statement of being that there is. Earth person, not earth woman or man, not woman or man from any particular country or of any color. She uses all those things that make her unique to express a message that brings us all closer to being the same. I think it's a wonderful work to look at, and also something that's really going to spark a lot of conversation this semester.
What caught my attention about it was seeing all the different media that she's done in this. I mean, it's a collage in part, and in part it looks like she's got different prints of similar images. And
absolutely. So this series of prints, the lithography would have been the part that's identical throughout the series. But yes, by hand, the feathers, the leather, the filaments and everything else are all hand applied. And so if you see images of different items in this series, you'll see a slightly different work every time, as different as the people we meet on the street every day. This is a piece by Earl Hooks. This is part of the original Paul R. Jones gift, and it is a representation of the Blues Boy King, which is what BB stands for, BB King. A long time ago was known as the Blues Boy, and so that's where we get his initials and his name. Now this piece, like some of the others, has a particular meaning to me because I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, listening to B.B. King, Bobby Bland, and some of the giants of the blues, either from my era or from a generation or two before me. And so it's wonderful to see an artist, a visual artist, and a sculptor has put into this medium a representation of such a great pioneer for music.
After our tour, Kayla and I talked to some of the people attending the opening reception about their reactions to the artwork.
Excuse me, before you walk away, can I get you to tell me what you see in this B.B. King piece?
I see a joyous face. I see some surface fetish.
A surface fetish?
He's obviously into the hyper matte and glossy. I like the shape. It's kind of amorphous. It looks kind of comfy. Looks heavy.
Funny you said comfy, because that was the first thing I saw across the room was that sort of soft shape, but it is hard material.
Yeah, it kind of draws you in and feels kind of comforting. There it is.
Excuse me, sir, I don't see any orchestra around here.
It's a symphony of colors.
James Anderson conducts the University of Delaware Symphony Orchestra. What are you seeing here?
Well, I'm really impressed by this merging, especially the artists over here, Charles Scheer, the merging of African art and music and dance and all these different styles coming together. It's spectacular colors and patterns.
I mean, particularly with that triptych over there on the far wall, you can almost sense some movement as a result of the colors.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it's really striking.
So what's your impression of Blue Rondo?
I'm struck by the colors of this. It's really a depth to the blues and the angular elements are very urban.
Okay, my name is Bill Schafferman. I'm a scientist at the Institute of Energy Conversion and professor of material science.
What's attracted you to this particular piece?
I have always been interested in sort of three-dimensional art with wires. Some of my favorite artists have worked in this medium, so that's what initially attracted me to it. Then I saw the title, I saw the sun in it, and I saw the title was I Get My Power from the Sun, and that made me especially interested because I'm very interested in solar energy. And so I was looking at the connection between the power and the wires and the sun image, and I find it quite appealing.
once you see that that's the name, then suddenly like this big piece of copper,
yes,
makes sense.
Yes, that's often true. Sometimes you look at a piece of art and you form an opinion, then you look at the name and sometimes it totally changes your perspective. You start looking for different things.
I like how it's got both a sense of an organic shape and something mechanical.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. It's actually, you could see a flower, you could see the suns, but very organic shapes, absolutely.
Cool. Thank you.
My pleasure.
I feel like I'm in like a uptown Philadelphia gallery.
That's exactly what I felt when I walked into. Yeah. It's terrific in here.
This is so contemporary. It's fascinating to see so many people and seeing this vibrant color come to life in such a dark space. A show like this is important to have the mixture of art but also history, and that, you know, coming from a university that's so in-depthly ingrained with the art history department and the art department, I think it's good and important for students like us and seniors like myself to come here, especially on opening night, to convey the point that this is important to us and we support the arts.
I really like
African Rainbow.
African Rainbow, and then
that one I think is the most lively piece up here.
Yeah, most vibrant for sure.
I love that it's juxtaposed with the wiring on the wall too.
We hope you enjoyed our visit to the opening reception of the University Museum's exhibition, Blue and Black African Rainbow, at the Mechanical Hall Gallery. All four University Museum galleries are free and open to the public during the fall and spring semesters. They're open Wednesdays, noon to 8 p.m., and noon to 5 p.m., Thursdays through Sundays. This semester's exhibitions are open through May 15th. For more information on all the University Museum's exhibitions, go to www.udel.edu/museums. Thanks for listening to Campus Voices on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark.